You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Larry Sinclair from Sinclair News LS News Group. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Larry, you, of course, were in the news several years ago about some allegations against now President Obama. Before we get into that, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are, where were you born, and run through your life in as quick or slow fashion as you'd like to?
Well, my name is Lawrence, or Larry Sinclair. I was born in Camden, South Carolina in 1961. Spent the first 15 years of my life in South Carolina before heading out west. I currently reside in Port Orange, Florida, where I try to operate SinclairNews.net and LSNewsGroup.com, which is an independent online media or news organization. I do a talk radio program Monday through Friday on the Rents Radio Network called Through the Mirror with Larry Sinclair, and am currently finishing up the final touches on my soon-to-be-released follow-up to my first book, Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder, with When One Man Stands, that will be out on September 18th.
Okay. So you were born in South Carolina, you said, right? A town called Camden. I guess Camden is most well known nowadays for Camden, New Jersey, that horrific town that has been destroyed by its denizens. But Camden, where is that exactly in South Carolina?
Well, Camden, South Carolina is the county seat for Kershaw County. It's approximately 30 miles east-northeast of the capital, Columbia. It's got a history to it. Historic Camden was actually the first fort that was built to stage off the British and still sits where it originally sat. It's historical for Andrew Jackson during his military days as well, and it also holds the Camden Military Academy, which I managed to avoid being put in at a young age.
Do you have any connections with your hometown?
I still keep in touch with friends that I've known since I was a kid. I still have some family in the area. Every now and then I will swing in between trips north to D.C. or Pennsylvania and stop in and say hello to people. But outside of that, Camden's not a place that anyone who is looking for something more exciting or something that will occupy your time, it's not that type of place to where you're going to find it. If you're looking to just get by and be content with what's available, then hey, it's perfect for you. But it hasn't been my type of residence area for quite some time. In fact, I could not have left sooner if I had wanted to. I left at 15, so it's definitely not a place I want to set roots in.
I got you. And are your folks still living?
My father is deceased. He actually lived there his entire life. My mother is currently in Louisiana.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear about your dad. Are you still in touch with your mom?
Actually, my mother and I speak almost on a daily basis. She is proud of the fact that she thinks that I got my stubborn streak and my refusal to back down from anyone from her.
You grew up in South Carolina. You got out of there when you were 15, and now I guess you're either 50 or 51, right?
I am 50. I will be 51 in about 2 months.
From 15 until when you came onto the political scene, I guess that was in 2008, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Between those times, anything significant happened in your life?
I just basically lived my life. I have some indiscretions with the law, you might want to call them. Other people refer to them as a criminal history, which is fair because it is, in fact, crimes and convictions. I have been portrayed as having a 27-year career criminal crime record, which is not anywhere close to the truth. At 18, got involved in writing checks that I knew didn't have the money in the bank to cover, and eventually was charged with theft and pled guilty. I've done a couple of stints within correctional facilities in the state of Arizona, Florida, and Colorado. My criminal record actually encompasses the years of 1980 through 1986, and unless my math is off, I don't think that adds up to a 27-year career criminal history, but let people decide for themselves. Spent a few years in Mexico in the later years. I have lived in just about every place you could possibly want to live in this country. When I left South Carolina, like I said, I went out west to Colorado with my mother. From there, I went to Arizona, California, Texas, Minnesota, New Jersey, Delaware. I've just lived.
Here you are, you're living your life, doing whatever you're doing. You had a couple of run-ins with the law, like many people do. Nothing serious. You did a couple of things that were stupid, and you admitted that you did them, and you paid the price, right?
Exactly.
Is it true that there's a state or a few states that have an arrest warrant out for you?
There is a 2000. 2001 warrant in the state of Colorado, which is restricted to the jurisdiction of the state of Colorado. I have a copy of the warrant in my possession. I only found out about it when I was crossing the U.S.-Mexican border one day, and immigration had stopped me and says, well, wait a minute, something popped up. And they contacted Colorado authorities, and at that time were informed that the warrant itself was non-extraditable. It was something that if I was stopped within the jurisdiction of Colorado. It became an issue in the 2008 campaign because those who didn't appreciate my allegations against Barack Obama tried to make hay with it. They began contacting Colorado officials, the district attorney's office out of the 10th Judicial District in Pueblo, demanding that they extradite no matter where I'm at, making ridiculous claims on the internet. I had been in contact with the district attorney's office at a Grand Rapids, Michigan rally that Obama was taking part in. In October of 2008, I was stopped by the Grand Rapids police outside of the rally because I was interrupting Obama's speech with a megaphone. And I was told that I needed to contact Colorado because every time they pull you over, they run a check. And they told me the same thing, that they're not going to extradite. I spoke with the assistant district attorney by the name of James Corsi with the Pueblo District Attorney's Office repeatedly throughout the 2008 campaign cycle, offering to go to Colorado, turn myself in, bond out, and let this matter take its course. The assistant district attorney by the name of James Corsi, on October 3rd of 2008, repeated what he had told me months earlier on the phone, which was, do not come to Colorado. Do not waste the money, the time, and the effort to come out here. The charges are going to be dismissed. When that was made public, within 24 hours, that case had been taken out of Corsi's hands and put into actually one of his subordinates' case files. And this subordinate apparently has political drive, or did have political drive, and he insisted that he was not dropping anything. I have not avoided this thing. I have worked with the district attorney's office since I first found out about it, which was back in 2004, I believe. I've provided the district attorney's office with more than enough evidence to show that their complaint is completely unfounded. Because of political harassment, and political harassment only, is the only reason that warrant still exists this day. They've recently had an election and have elected a new district attorney in the area, and what they decide to do with it is up to them. But I have done exactly what I was told to do by the district attorney's office, which is not to waste the money, which I didn't have the money to begin with, but not to waste the money to make a trip out there for something that they can not prosecute.
And what is the actual matter?
What it is a former neighbor and friend, along with a former roommate, signed over their tax refund checks to pay a debt that they owed for furniture that they bought and money that was loaned to buy an automobile at a car auction in Pueblo. This took place in 2000. They waited until 2001 to claim that their tax refund checks had been stolen and forged by me. I provided the district attorney's office with credit card receipts showing the purchase at the auto auction in Pueblo, off of Pueblo Boulevard, that showed the exact amount of money that was paid to buy this young man an automobile at the time. And I provided the district attorney's office with police reports from the state of Texas out of El Paso, where the individual's sister-in-law had filed a false police report there, accusing me of stealing a truck that they had sold to me because they didn't want to lose it in yet another repossession. They decided, apparently after their finances got in order, that they wanted me to get the truck back to them. I refused to do that unless, of course, they reimbursed me for the payments that were made and the repairs that were made. And because they couldn't get it any other way, they filed an actual auto theft report in October of 2000. But the detective with the El Paso County Sheriff's Department had already been in touch with me. He already had the payment receipts for the payments made on the vehicle, the fact that they had delivered the vehicle to me on, I believe, April 1st of the year 2000, and the charges were originally filed, and then he immediately took them out of the system. So after they couldn't get their truck back that way, approximately 9 months later, all of a sudden, the sister files complaint in Colorado out alleging that I stole her tax refund checks and forged them. They were deposited into my bank account. They were co-signed by me for that purpose. I've never denied that they were deposited there. However, they were never stolen. They were never forged. And if people would stop and actually look at the information that's available rather than just simply jumping and saying, oh, he stole somebody's tax checks, they might not be preaching as much right now about the Colorado thing.
And that's the only state that has any issues.
That is the only outstanding warrant of any kind that anyone has any knowledge of, or that, in all honesty, according to the United States Secret Service, that there's any record of. Let me back up a minute. Let's go to 2004, the Democratic National Convention. You have a fairly unknown Illinois senator who is making a speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. And that fairly unknown senator, state senator, is Barack Obama. And you have me sitting in my living room in Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, watching the convention on TV, and almost falling on the floor, realizing that an individual that I had engaged in consensual sexual acts and drug activity in 1999 was now right there in front of my face on the TV screen, giving a keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. Imagine my surprise. Now, people in 2008 asked me when I told them that's the first I ever realized who this person was. After the meeting in 1999, people say, well, why didn't you say anything then? And what people don't seem to understand is I have lived a life to where I know people who are in politics, who are in the corporate world, who are even in the church, that if I wanted to go out and simply tell things about them for the purpose of trying to hurt them or whatever, I could do that. There's one thing you learn living in the border states. There's also something you learn by living in Mexico. And that is, just because people are in politics or in the corporate world doesn't make them above engaging in things that most people would say, oh, well, he's too good to know people like that. What people don't understand is people who engage in these things, who participate in illicit drug activity, or who engage in extramarital affairs, of course, when they do that, that's exactly the type of person they associate with. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. But this is what happened in 2004. That's how I realized that the young man I had met and had a couple of sexual encounters with and engaged in the use of cocaine with in 1999 in Chicago, while visiting to watch my godson graduate from Navy basic training in Great Lakes.
Let's go to the time that you met him. Where was this and where were you in your life at that time?
It was in November of 1999. It was in Chicago. Where I was at that point in my life is I was on parole from the Colorado Department of Corrections, finishing out my sentence from a 1986 conviction. I was traveling. Earlier in the month, I had actually traveled to South Carolina with permission. What people did not know was that I was actually involved in moving large quantities of marijuana and cocaine from Colorado and New Mexico to the East Coast. That's where I was in my life.
What was a conviction in Colorado about?
It was unauthorized use of a financial transaction device, which specifically means that I use someone's credit card without having the authority to do so.
Okay.
The second charge was second-degree forgery, which if people would take the time to actually look at the transcripts of the court record, you would see that even though I pled guilty to it, at the time of pleading guilty, I specifically asked the judge that I wasn't sure that forgery was an accurate charge, considering the fact that I never signed anyone's name other than my own. We did appeal that particular guilty plea, and the Colorado Supreme Court and Court of Appeals had determined that we had waited beyond the time frame for appealing it. So it was left to stand, which it didn't matter because the only argument was is I wanted to make it clear that I did not sign anyone's name other than my own. Like I said, I was on parole.
Mm-hmm.
I had traveled to South Carolina with permission. Only I had promised my godson Lee that I would actually be there in South Carolina for his high school graduation. I could not make that. I knew he was joining the Navy, and I swore on everything that I loved in life that I would be there when he graduated basic training. I had returned from South Carolina, and rather than go through the process of notifying my parole officer that I need needed to travel to Chicago. And because the time constraints, I ended up getting on a flight out of Colorado Springs late the night of November 2nd, flying into Chicago by way of Salt Lake City, Cincinnati, Louisville, and then O'Hare. I was in Chicago. I had already made arrangements to use the services of Five Star Limousine Service, which I got out of the phone book, and had already hired them for a couple of nights before Lee even graduated from basic training.
Larry, why did you rent a limousine? What was the purpose of that?
Well, the purpose of renting the limo, one, was because I was making enough money moving illegal contraband across the country to where I could afford to actually take Lee out once he graduated from basic training. I have always been adamant that I will not drink and drive under any circumstances. Limos were the means in which you could go out, you could drink, you could get drunk, and you wouldn't have to worry about getting into an accident or going to jail. It wasn't unusual for me to do this. I had already used the services of First Class Limo Service out of Columbia, South Carolina months earlier on my trips back to South Carolina and continued to use them throughout the year of 2000. It was something that I would do. It was something that I did not have a problem doing, and it was something that sometimes I actually enjoyed doing.
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Before the 5th of November, which was Friday, before the graduation, Lee could not leave the Great Lakes Navy training facility. So his grandmother and his aunt, who I have known since childhood, they had arrived the day after me, and they were staying at another hotel in another area close to the training facility. I was actually staying at the Comfort Inn and Suites in Gurnee, which was the closest that I could find to the event at the last minute. So we went out the first night that they got into town. We took Five Star out and went around Chicago. And I had talked to the limo driver on the very first night and explained that even though I had made reservations to have them available throughout the week, that if Lee was not able to leave the base on Saturday, that I would still use them, and that if he knew anyone that lived in the Chicago area that would enjoy just going out and partying and showing me around. There was never any implications that any type of sexual actions were hinted at or anything like that.
Okay, now let me just get this straight here. This is November 1999, right?
Mm-hmm.
You came into Chicago what day? November 2nd, right?
I actually arrived in Chicago early morning, November 3rd. I had flown out of Colorado Springs Airport on November 2nd. It was, I believe, Delta's last flight out of the Colorado Springs Airport that evening. And that flight actually took me to Salt Lake City. And I can say this with conviction because I ended up having an extensive layover in Salt Lake City. And Salt Lake City Airport at the time was selling all of this 2000 Olympic game collectibles, you know, the shot glasses, the mug, and all of this stuff, because I'd actually bought one of the shot glasses. The flight from Salt Lake City took me into Cincinnati, St. Louis, and then on into Chicago, O'Hare.
Okay, you get in on Wednesday, November 3rd, mm-hmm. and your godson is graduating from Great Lakes, Illinois, basic training on Friday, November 5th.
Correct.
Okay.
I rented a car from Hertz Rent-A-Car at Chicago O'Hare. The car itself was a Mazda. Color was blue. The tags were expired. What people need to understand is I did have a vehicle at my disposal. However, I was not in the mood to be driving around Chicago trying to party.
Right.
So I did rent Five Star Limo Services. Like I said, Pam and Delma, which is Lee's grandmother and aunt, and myself, we went out the night that they arrived. We took Lee out on Friday the 5th after the graduation. Saturday, Lee was not able to go out, or he actually was with his family. I'm almost at the point to where he wasn't allowed to leave the base, and that's the position that I've always held.
Right.
It could be different than that, but that's the way I remember it happening, because I ended up using the limo service on Saturday the 6th alone. So it just happened to be on Saturday, the driver, again, Jagir Mutani, with Five Star car limo, had contacted me before picking me up, letting me know that he had a friend that was interested in showing me around Chicago. So he picked me up at the hotel, which was in Gurnee. We drive into Chicago. I'm not really paying a whole lot of attention to streets or street signs. At that time, that's something I could care less. If I'm not driving, I don't care where I'm at because I don't need to remember how to get the hell out. But anyway, we're driving in. We get into Chicago. I know it's a one-way street because he opens the rear door on the driver's side to let me out of the limo. When I'm stepping out of the limo, there's a young, skinny black man standing there that is introduced to me by name, by Barack Obama. The name doesn't ring any bells to me. I'm not from Chicago, never lived there. I'm not into Chicago politics. And contrary to a lot of the Obama faithful's arguments that this man was just too famous in 1999 to even risk associating with scumbags like Larry Sinclair, don't really know much about Barack Obama's history, because in 1999, this was one broke-ass Illinois state senator.
Okay.
This was an individual who not only associated with scumbags like Larry Sinclair, but actually associated with even bigger so-called scumbags.
Right.
If the media had taken the time to walk through Chicago's gay community and talk to people and not be set out to destroy their lives with information that they were provided, the media probably would have known a little bit more about Obama's background rather than just pumping up dreams of my father or the audacity of hope. What people need to understand is this is a man who, despite the fact that he had his first daughter who was almost a year and a half old, was also having severe marital problems with Michelle, and things were not hunky-dory and all snuggly and lovey on the home front.
This fellow Obama, or at least one of his names, is Barack Hussein Obama II, and he was ostensibly born August 4th, 1961, in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I'm reading this from Wikipedia, of course. This is all disputed. Everything. Mm-hmm. His name, his date of birth, and his place of birth. It looks like he married Michelle Robinson in 1992, and his first daughter, Malia, was born in 1998.
In July.
And Sasha was born in 01. This happened again. I'm going to look
in
at the
November
calendar.
In November of 1999.
Give me that date. That this was the Saturday. This was November
Saturday,
6th.
November 6th.
Saturday, November 6th, 1999. How did you remember this limo driver's name? Did you have a card or anything? Did you write down his name? Do you have a diary or how did you remember?
Actually, what I had with me is I had some old credit card files. If you go through my file cabinets or my files, you will find paperwork, receipts, letters, and stuff from 30 years back.
Right.
I would be willing to bet you could find some stuff that goes back even further than that,
right.
Probably close to 45 years.
Wow, so moving around as much as you did, you lugged all this stuff with you.
I don't lug furniture and appliances or electronics other than my computer right now, but anytime I move, my paperwork, everything I have on paper goes with me. Some of it's gotten lost or misplaced along the way, but I still have quite a bit of it. But it wasn't so much having to remember, because a friend of mine that was living in Chicago at the time had done some work with them, and that helped me remember exactly who the driver was. I did have credit card records from the original night, the first night that we took it out, because at one of the credit cards that I was using, the driver claimed that the card was declined, and we ended up paying him in cash. And then only later, after returning from Chicago, did I find out from my credit card records that the credit card company had been charged as well. So I had actually filed a claim on that particular charge. So that's how I knew who I was referring to.
His name was on the credit card?
The name was actually on the dispute.
What kind of a name is that? Did you know that?
Indian.
Okay. The door opens, and here's this skinny black guy. Did he come into the limousine then?
No, actually, he was standing outside of a bar. We went in, and I've tried to get records from Citigroup so that I could actually give the correct name of the bar, because there would be purchase records on those credit card statements. But Citigroup has, since 2008, steadily claimed that they no longer have those records, so that they're not available. I find that to be questionable, but we went into the bar. It wasn't really a long period of time. We went in, we sat down, had a drink, started talking. It was all small talk. There was nothing that would indicate that he was a Illinois state senator. He did refer to himself as being in public service, but you know what? You can be a dog catcher and be in public service.
What type of a bar was it?
It was an upscale, kind of laid-back lounge. They did have music. It was not something that you would see a whole bunch of winos going into. It had some class to it. In fact, I would almost be willing to say that I had been there the first night that we went out in the limo with Lee's grandmother and aunt. And to this day, I've said that I want to say it was Alibis, but I can't say that and be 100% certain. I was even trying to find a couple of shot glasses. This is how desperate I was to prove that I was actually telling the truth in 2008. I started calling family and friends who I knew had been given some of my glass collections before I moved out of Colorado in 2000, just to see if one of them still had the actual shot glasses that I had ended up buying off the bar the first night.
Did you ever think about going back there to the town to look for it?
You know, this goes back to when I said I really wasn't paying attention to where I was driving. If I am driving somewhere, and this is something that I learned from a job that I used to hold, but if I'm driving somewhere, I actually pay attention to things around me on the way there because they serve as markers so that you know where you're at the next time. But when I'm not driving, I don't do that. I wish I had have done that, but I don't.
Is your hunt for this place done?
Yeah, because I think we're far beyond that at this point. A gentleman that did an interview with me on Tuesday asked me the same question, if I was interested in or if it was my desire to continue to push to provide even more documentation on the truthfulness of my accounts. And I told them that at this point, I would love for people to be able to see records that I think do still exist, but I don't have the money and the resources
right.
to force these companies to turn those records over. But I'm at the point now to where I think it's not so much anymore. I think just what has happened since making the allegations in 2008 serves as enough to make people really start to question the honesty of Barack Obama, the campaign itself, and the media in how they reported information about this guy.
Right, or didn't report information about the guy.
Exactly.
Let's get back to the bar. What time is this so about?
It was in the evening, I want to say, and don't hold me to this because other people were trying to pin me down to exact hours. I'm not going to do that. I would say it was in the early evening. I know it was dark already. I know that the limo driver had picked me up at around 6:30 or 7. It would have been a good 45-minute, if not longer, drive into Chicago from the Gurnee suburb. It was early evening.
Okay. What were you drinking?
What I always drink, Grey Goose or Absolut.
Okay. And what was he drinking?
I believe he was drinking Crown Royal. I may be mistaken, but my memory serves me that he was actually drinking Crown Royal. The conversation was brief. Like I said, there was nothing that was real personal or detailed. But all of a sudden, I had made a comment. I'd made the comment to him that I could really use a line to wake up.
By that, you mean a line of blow, cocaine.
Exactly. By saying that, it was clear to me by his response that he knew exactly what I was talking about because he actually asked me if I was referring to coke, and I told him I was. And he had said that he had a source he could actually provide that. So we get out. He makes a phone call. We get back in the limo. He tells the driver where we're going. I would say we drove approximately 30, 45 minutes max. Before we pulled over, stopped, he gets out and says he'll be back. And about 5, 10 minutes later, he shows back up with an 8-ball of coke that I had given him $250 to purchase.
Okay, and for the benefit of the listeners, tell him what 8-ball is.
An 8-ball basically is 1/8 of an ounce. Just like a quarter is a quarter, just like a half is a half, it is 1/8 of an ounce. An ounce is 28 grams. 1/8 of that would be what, 3.7? It's referred to as an 8-ball. So he comes back. He hands me an 8-ball of coke. I have a CD tray from a compact disc, and I would be willing to bet that it was a Los Temerarios CD because I traveled with a lot of Spanish language music on disc, and I start to set up a line with the CD tray resting on his knee. As I'm doing this, the CD tray is actually resting on his left knee. Yep, his left knee.
Okay.
So I start to do a line. In the process, I start moving my hand. and this is what people challenge, and I tell people, look, when you're openly gay, you always have been gay. You know instinctively who you can or cannot get away with making physical advances towards, or at least you think you know. But one thing that I know for a fact is when one man starts rubbing his hand up another man's thigh, heading towards his crotch, if that man's not interested, he's not just going to sit there and let it happen. He's going to pull away or else he's going to swing at you. But the bottom line is he's not going to just sit there and continue to allow you to do it.
You did that to him?
I did that to him, and that's exactly what he did. He sat there and allowed it to happen.
How was he dressed? I forgot to ask.
Casually, kind of preppy.
You started rubbing, I guess, the inside of his thigh?
I started rubbing up on the inside of his thigh. It went to him actually undoing his pants. And from there, it went to fondling, and then I began to perform oral sex on him.
Where was the Indian guy at this time?
He's driving. We're actually in the limo, driving around. So I began performing oral sex. It's at that time that he actually stops to lower his pants and his shorts down past his knees, down to where they're resting around his ankles. But beforehand, he reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out a glass pipe and a packet of crack cocaine. And he actually tells me that it makes him perform better. It actually makes him stay hard longer, which I thought was somewhat interesting because most of my experiences with people who use crack cocaine, it tends to do just the opposite.
Okay.
But hey, you know, I'm one of those weird people where things react just the opposite of the way they say they're supposed to. So who knows? Maybe he is too.
Okay.
But anyway, he actually asked me to reach over because there's a lighter in the cup holder on the side there that's behind me. And he asked me to reach over and hand him the lighter. I reach over and pass him the lighter, and he starts to smoke a crack rock right there in the back of the limo.
For the benefit of the listeners, again, who don't really know, what exactly is crack?
Crack cocaine is a cooked rock form of cocaine. Cocaine, if it is not cut with a filler. And most dealers and most drug cartels will not sell you pure 100% cocaine. In most cases, you will purchase a powdered form of cocaine that is cut with something. What crack cocaine is people taking the powdered form of cocaine and cooking it in boiling water with baking soda. And after it is cooked, it starts to form into rock form. And then it's immediately filled with cold water or ice that makes those rock forms solidify.
Okay.
And then it's cut into little chunks, and then it's put inside of a pipe or on top of a soda can that someone has poked holes in the side of with a nail or a straight pin or whatever.
Right.
And it is lit with a lighter, and it is smoked, similar to a cigarette, similar to a pipe. The crack cocaine with the flame starts to melt and turns into an oily type substance. It produces a smoke that is inhaled similar to that of a cigarette that causes people to immediately get a faster high. The high is similar to that of a speed high. A lot of people who use crack cocaine get real high real fast and crash almost as fast unless they continue to smoke it over a period of time. Now, some people will argue that crack cocaine is highly addictive and people cannot be considered recreational users. If you know anything about using drugs or have been around the use of drugs, I would tend to argue that point. While most people really do become highly addicted to it, I know people that even to this day are still what you would consider recreational users that you would never in a million years believe ever touched anything, much less a crack rock or a crystal meth rock. But they do.
He lights it up, right?
He lights it up. He starts to smoke. The one thing I don't do at that point is I had experiences with crack cocaine back in the 1980s when I lived in Miami Beach, when it was first becoming the new rave. It's not something that I enjoy doing, and I simply stuck to snorting lines of coke, which is fine with me.
Where was Mr. Mutani at the time? Did they have that window that would close?
The privacy partition was still up.
And did he roll down the window a little bit to get the smoke out of the car?
Actually, I had the window cracked just a little bit.
You had a crack to get the crack out. Right? But he didn't.
No, I'm actually a smoker. I know actually that the sunroof on, or the moonroof, or whatever you want to call it, on the limo was slightly cracked. not big enough to where somebody driving by in an 18-wheeler could actually look in and see what the hell somebody was doing. But it was slightly cracked, and I've always done that no matter where I'm at or what limo.
I don't know. How fast does this stuff react? Does it react pretty quickly?
Let me explain from personal experience.
Okay.
And I will tell you from personal experience, almost within 30 seconds of inhaling the first drag that you pull off of this rock, and people need to understand, this is not something that you put the fire to and you leave the fire to it. In glass cylinder pipes for crack cocaine, it's similar to a weed pipe where you can actually put your finger over an exhaust hole and you will draw in the smoke from burning the crack cocaine with the lighter, but you remove the lighter. The one thing you don't do with crack cocaine is you don't just simply sit there and keep the fire on it until the entire rock is melted, because what you end up doing is you end up heating yourself out of most of the effects of it. But the oil itself, when you take your finger off of that hole and you allow it to cool after taking the first hit, you continue to heat up the glass pipe, and the heat turns the oil back into even more smoke that you would draw out of it and inhale. Crack cocaine has an almost instant effect on anyone. You will begin to feel the effects of smoking crack cocaine within seconds of taking that and inhaling that first hit.
Okay, and did you notice that that had happened to him?
I noticed that he definitely became a little more relaxed for a few seconds, but I also noticed that after about the second hit that he exhibited the same effects that I had seen in the 80s in Miami Beach, where you watch someone get very high very fast, and then you watch their body start reacting to the fact that they're coming down. But that's the effects of crack cocaine. Some people control it better than others. Some people need to continue to keep their level at a certain level to where they're feeling a certain effect. I've seen other people actually smoke a rock and put a pipe away and not go back to it for 2 days.
But in this case, Obama exhibited the type of behavior that you would expect a normal person would do.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, look, he took the first hit off of the rock. He definitely felt the effects of inhaling it. I tried to answer these questions based on personal experience, people that I've been around that use this stuff, as well as my own personal reactions when I tried it in 1985. Well, I had proceeded to perform oral sex on him, and you could tell that he was definitely feeling the effects from smoking the crack cocaine, because he had engaged in additional behaviors that, to me, some people would say, oh, it was a result of being high. I don't think so. I think it's a result of someone feeling comfortable with what they're doing. There were some interactions where Obama had actually started to kiss on the back of my neck while performing oral sex. Most men who simply surrender to a drunken state don't necessarily go that far. So it was obvious to me from that point that this was not something that was foreign to him. This was something that he had engaged in on previous occasions. It was something he was quite comfortable with. But basically, what ended up happening is we continued, oral sex was completed. We continued to drive around for a while, talk, drink, and at one point, I just simply had decided that I was exhausted. I mean, I had been up constantly since returning to Colorado from South Carolina and then flying out to Chicago, and I had decided to call it a night.
Before you call it a night, you said that oral sex was completed. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, let's just say that it reached the ultimate result of ejaculation. I want to try to keep this as clean and...
Well, you know what? I mean, I think probably this may be one of the most exhaustive interviews you've done. And it is clean. The people listening to this can either turn it off or continue listening because it is explicit. But what exactly happened?
I answered this question with 100% honesty back in the summer of 2008, and I was beaten over the head with it by people from all sides, not just the Obama idiots. An explicit term was used to say that this was just too disgusting and that people were turned off by it. What I can say and will say at this point is that oral sex reached its ultimate conclusion. It didn't stop halfway, and it was a sexual encounter that terminated with the expected result.
Did his pants get dirty?
Only, I think, with him having them down on the floor of the limo and pulling them back up. But if you ask me, did his pants get stained? I don't think so.
Okay. Since we're on that topic, was he happy with what happened?
I think he was extremely happy.
So you're tired, you want to call it a night, and what happened? Did you tell him this? Did you say, look, buddy, you know, I had fun, but it's time for me to go?
Well, you know, I did. I had basically told him that, you know, I was kind of at the point to where I needed to call it a night. I had told the limo driver the same thing. It was the limo driver himself, Jagir Mutani, who had suggested that he would take me back to my hotel first and then take Obama back to wherever he was going to be taken to. The limo driver made it perfectly clear that it was more convenient for him and suggested that he take me back to my hotel first and then he would take Obama back to wherever he needed to be taken to. I had no problem with that. So that was the arrangement that was made. That's exactly the way it took place.
Okay, what time was this approximately?
We were already into the early morning hours. I'm not going to give you an exact hour because I honestly could not tell you an exact hour.
You were with him maybe for 5 hours?
From the time we met to the time that I was dropped off at the hotel, I would say at least four and a half hours.
All right.
But by this time, from a time date standpoint, it was already Sunday the 7th when I got back to my hotel.
Okay.
They dropped me back off at the hotel. I said goodnight. I was polite, made the comment that maybe if I'm ever back in the area, whatever. The general, thank you very much. Nice to meet you. So I'm actually in my hotel room Sunday the 7th when I hear a knock on the door. And when I go to answer the door and look through the peephole, imagine my surprise when I'm looking at the very gentleman that I had just engaged in oral sex earlier the night before or morning of, standing at my hotel room door.
Okay, what time was this, Lair?
It would be in the early evening of Sunday, November 7th.
Okay.
And what I have found since going public was that this would also be the anniversary of his mother's death. I answer the door. I invite him in. It's nothing more than another opportunity to engage in a sexual act that apparently he enjoyed the previous night because he's actually looking for a second round. He does enter the hotel with more cocaine, offering more to me, and I made it clear that I still had some from the night before. The incident within the hotel room, I would say, lasted a maximum of an hour and a half at the most. It was not something that I had planned for, wasn't something I had expected. It was something that took place. I was at the time of the mood and the attitude, oh, what the hell? It's not like I was busy doing anything else.
And what exactly happened?
He comes in, he makes it clear that he was looking for a second round of oral sex. This time he decides to get a little more comfortable. He's actually laying on the bed in the hotel room. At this point, his pants actually get removed to a more complete level than what they were in the back of the limo. He engages in smoking even more crack cocaine in the hotel room. I perform yet a second round of oral sex on him and pretty much get to the point to where, okay, it was nice meeting you. Great that you decided you enjoyed it enough that you wanted a round two, but I'm like, okay, I need to get ready because I'm packing, getting ready to fly out of Chicago the next morning. But what I want people to understand is you have to take this whole event in context. I never once intended to bring out anything in the campaign of 2008 about any sexual encounters with Barack Obama. That was not my intent. It was not my interest. As far as I was concerned, it really was not an issue with his candidacy. My issue with Barack Obama's candidacy was his constant claim of transparency and being a new type of politics in America and seeing people saying that the reason they support him and that they're so excited about his candidacy is because of the level of his honesty about his past drug use. Let's face it, Barack Obama is one of the first presidential candidates that's ever publicly admitted to engaging in cocaine use. And it was something that was appealing to the younger voters.
And to you, it was appalling because he's
a
liar.
To me, it was appalling because he was trying to take the benefit of admitting that he used it to appeal to the younger college crowd youth vote, while at the same time trying to appeal to the older, more straight-laced voter in saying, okay, yes, I admit to doing it, but you don't need to hold that as a negative because, let's face it, who didn't experiment with drugs in their high school and college days?
Well, Bill Clinton, but he didn't inhale.
Exactly, exactly. And see, this was exactly the way I was taking his campaign approach, that he wanted to benefit from the admission that, yeah, hey, you know, I was cool at one time, I actually did this, while at the same time not trying to look hypocritical like Bill Clinton and saying, yeah, I smoked, but I didn't inhale.
Right. How was he dressed this Sunday evening?
Again, it was quite casual. There was nothing formal about it. And when I say quite casual, I'm going to say flats and a polo type shirt. In other words, he didn't show up in coat and tie.
Okay. And in 99, did he have an afro or was he kind of closely cropped?
His hair was actually shorter, more closely cropped. If you ask me if he had hair that stood out 5 inches high, no.
Was he a very talkative fella?
You know what? Sunday he was not. And like I said, Saturday when I first met him, the talk was small talk. The one thing that I noticed about him is that he really was not into wanting people to really know who he was or what he was.
Well, that makes sense.
And I understand that. And like I said, what people need to understand is this meeting that was set up by the limo driver, at no time, and this needs to be made perfectly clear, at no time did I ever insinuate or give the limo driver any reason to believe that I was looking for sexual hookup, because
right.
I wasn't.
Now, are you, and I should have asked this earlier, but you're gay?
I am openly gay. I have been gay my entire life. I am one of those faggots, excuse my French, and I know some people will take offense to that, but I can use that term. I'm not offended by it. I tell people I am one of those faggots that never knew what the inside of a closet looked like.
Okay.
I'm one of those lifelong gay men who has known from early childhood of what my sexual preference was. I've never hidden it. I've never felt the need that I needed other people's approval or acceptance to feel comfortable with who I am or what I am. And I tend to make quite a few enemies with the gay activist segment of the population because I continue to ask them, why is it that you insist that people accept you or give you their stamp of approval in order for you to feel like you're equal?
Right. He heads out.
He heads out. There's not a problem. It becomes clear to me that his sole intent was simply he was looking to get off again, and that was pretty much it. He wasn't looking to make house. Now, what I want people to understand at the same time is the only way this man could have actually come to my hotel room was to either get the room number from the limo driver, which did have it, because they had to have it in order to call me and let me know that they were on their way, as well as how to contact me for the contract that we had with them. He either had gotten the room number from the limo driver, which is exactly the way I think it happened, because even for a Comfort Inn and Suites in Gurnee, Illinois, most standard hotel policies have always been that they don't give out an individual's room number to someone just walking up to the desk asking for it. And that's just strictly liability purposes. They
right.
just don't do it.
Right.
What they normally do will tell you to pick up the house phone in the lobby, and then they will ring the room and let the guest give the room number.
Okay, did you happen to know where Obama lived at the time?
No.
Okay, so through your research, you weren't able to uncover where he actually lived in November of 99?
No.
Okay. Do you think he lived near the village of Gurnee?
No, I know he didn't live near the village of Gurnee, actually. It's interesting that you asked that, because I never did even engage in any research to try to figure out where he lived in 99. But it's my understanding that he lived in the same community that he lives in now, or lived in before being elected.
He leaves. Did you guys kiss goodbye, or?
I'm not into kissing somebody goodbye, because to me that's like you're trying to set up a long-term relationship, and that was not something I was interested in. This was basically just that. It was a chance, one night stand that turned into a two-event affair. He leaves. I don't really think about this guy. I don't even give it a second thought as to wanting to know exactly who he was. It's no different than had I been a straight person and I had met a woman at a bar and we left and grabbed a hotel room for a quick one-night stand. He leaves. I get ready. I get packed up. I have to be at O'Hare Airport the following morning. I'm flying back to Colorado, which I did. Like I said, this is not something that you dwell on. It's not something that hasn't happened probably 100 times before in my lifetime. It's not something that I leave and I start having these daydreams and I want to pick up the phone and go, oh, please, can I meet you tonight?
Right. It was done.
Yeah, it was done. When I return to Colorado, I notify my parole officer that I've returned. What I didn't do was I didn't get permission to go to Chicago at all. What I had done was I had called and left a voice message on the parole officer's voicemail telling him that I had gotten delayed and that I was extending my trip to South Carolina for an additional time period. Well, technically, that doesn't qualify as having permission from your parole officer to be out of the state. So I got a phone call and was told to go in and report, which immediately resulted in my being taken into custody and placed in the Pueblo County Jail, basically for violating parole or the conditions of parole. So now we fast forward to 2004. I'm in Mexico. I am in the town of Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, a Pacific Coast state south of Sinaloa, Mazatlan, and north of Guadalajara, Jalisco, and Guerrero. I'm sitting there and I'm watching, for some reason, I'm watching the Democratic National Convention going on.
When is this? In the summer?
It was in August. Was it in August of 2004? It was definitely in the summer. I'm not sure the exact date of the convention, but I know it was in the summer of 2004.
Okay, I'll find out while you're talking. Go ahead.
Okay, but I do know that I'm in Mexico and I'm watching it on my TV screen. And like I said, I'm ready to fall off the couch because I see somebody that I had gone down on walking across the stage and being held as the next great hope of the Democratic Party.
Right. It was July 26th to the 29th. At the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts.
But like I said, I know it was the summer, and I was in Tijuana, Nayarit, Mexico, and I was watching it. And it was just the funniest thing. But it doesn't faze me, I mean, other than just laughing my ass off and going, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. But like I said, people need to understand this is not something that is unusual for politicians or anyone for that matter.
Right.
I mean, people climb the corporate ladder and the political ladder in a whole bunch of different ways. And not all of them are the squeaky, clean, fine, upstanding citizens that people want to refer to themselves
right, and want to believe. Yeah, and of course, yeah. A lot of this was just revealed in those lawsuits against that actor, John Travolta.
Exactly.
Where Travolta said that Hollywood is controlled by a bunch of gay Jews and you have to play the game to get along.
You're absolutely right. But unfortunately, people want to ignore the fact they want to try to promote Barack Obama and anyone associated with him for some reason as being this almighty, angel, godlike individual that just could not ever associate with the likes of Larry Sinclair. Well, he associated with the likes of Tony Rezgo for quite some time.
Right.
He associated with the likes of Stuart Levine, who arranged cocaine and gay sex-fueled parties in the Chicago gay community that he publicly sat in a courtroom and stated Barack Obama was a participant in on a regular basis. So people need to understand this is not just this godlike creature.
But I wanted to ask you, before you continued, you talked about how someone who's gay knows that if someone else is gay. Do you think he's gay or do you think he's bisexual? Or do you think he's heterosexual?
I'm glad you put it that way, or heterosexual, because you know how people in the gay community say, oh, well, you're born gay. It's not a choice. I tend to argue with that point. Yes, there are some people I truly believe are born gay that never made a conscious decision to be gay. It's just the way that they formed their opinions and their positions in life. However, I've also known in my lifetime some individuals who were not gay at all, but chose to engage in a gay lifestyle because they knew that emotionally it hurt their family or their parents or someone that they wanted to strike back at. If you ask me, is Barack Obama gay, bi, or hetero? The strict definition of bisexual, someone would say, would apply because there is claims that he has actually engaged in sexual activity with Michelle. If, in fact, he is the father of Malia and Sasha, which I think Malia definitely resembles him more than Michelle, then if you go by the strict definition, then yes, you could say he's bisexual. If you ask me emotionally what he himself really feels he is, I'd bet my life that Barack Obama is gay, who did a Jim McGreevy type thing and married for political purposes or for position and status in life. I think Michelle Obama was a door for him to get into the African American community in Chicago, which is something that he had never been able to accomplish on his own. In fact, if you go back with history, you don't see Barack Obama ever even really talking about the fact that he's black unless it had some political payoff for him.
You think he's gay?
I think he's got it. I do.
Okay.
So you're somewhere in Mexico, which probably you wouldn't want to be right now because of all the murders and beheadings that are happening.
Oh, please. That just makes life exciting in Mexico.
No thanks. I like my head. You see him on TV. This is almost 5 years has gone by. You haven't even thought of this guy.
Not even thought of him. But boy, I'm telling you, I have a memory that...
I could tell.
I have a memory that even scares my 96-year-old grandmother.
That's great, though. So almost 5 years goes by. You don't give this guy a second thought, a third thought, nothing. Zero zilch. It was just a good time, finished. All of a sudden, you see him on TV.
I start cracking up laughing is the first damn thing I do. Look, that's a badge of honor in Mexico when you can brag about the fact that you went down on a powerful politician or a connected individual. Come on. This was the new star of the Democratic Party. Are you kidding me? I was sitting there talking to some friends and neighbors, making light of the fact that now if this guy actually ever becomes somebody other than an Illinois senator, I mean, hey, I can talk one up on my belt.
Right. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I want to focus on this for a minute, because I want the listeners to listen to what we're saying here and to form their own opinion, because this is a very important part of the story here.
You know, it is, because people say, oh, well, you're just trying to get some fame off. If I was looking for notoriety and fame and fortune off of this, I could have done a hell of a lot better with this back in 2004 when he was the rising star of the Democratic Party. In 2004, again, for me personally, it was something to laugh at, but it was insignificant. And people say, well, the voters of Illinois. My concern is not the voters of Illinois or some Chicago Senate district that voted for this guy. This guy doesn't make any decisions that affect me. It doesn't matter to me. It's up to the people in the Chicago district that voted for this guy to put him in the Illinois Senate to want to know who he is. And it wouldn't have mattered. I didn't even bring it up publicly until 2008. And people say, well, why in 2008? Because in 2008, you had people standing there. They were enamored with this guy because this guy was honest. He was transparent. He was above all of it. There was no secret. He was not going to hide anything. So again, we come into 2007 when I'm seeing these people say this on television. So I asked the campaign, and this is what people need to understand. I didn't just go public and say, oh, by the way, Barack Obama used crack cocaine while I went down on him. That's not how this came about, although a lot of people seem to think it is. I committed 6 months of my life in 2007 of trying to get Barack Obama and the Obama campaign in the 2008 presidential election to simply figure out how they wanted to correct publicly his contradictions about the extent of his drug use and the time frames of it. And it wasn't just me knowing that he was lying as far as knowing that he was using crack cocaine as recently as 1999, but if people would go back over his public statements and interviews that he gave during the 2008 campaign cycle about the extent of his drug use, you can pull together a good 15 different interviews where he told one media outlet that he never did anything other than marijuana, only to find him giving another interview 2 weeks later saying that, okay, he used cocaine once in a while when he could afford it, to another interview where he swears he's never used any drug of any kind since high school, and then given another one later contradicting that, saying that he used in college. So what people need to understand is this wasn't just me going public on YouTube saying, oh, by the way, I blew this guy while he was smoking crack pipe. I spent 6 months asking the campaign to do the right thing, which is a phrase that Barack Obama likes to use quite a bit lately, and simply correct publicly their statement, their position on what drugs he used and when he stopped using them.
What motivated you to do that, actually?
Seeing this young lady on television while I was in Delaware in September of 2007, telling, I think it was MSNBC or CNN, that she was solidly behind the Obama candidacy and would volunteer because he was this honest and open candidate, and he had been more honest about everything that he had done. He was honest about using drugs and what drugs, and no other candidate had ever done that. That's what motivated me to contact the campaign.
But you were motivated because it was a lie.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that was the only thing I ever asked the campaign to do, was simply, look, here's the facts. He was doing crack cocaine in 1999. One, that's not just marijuana. Two, that's many years after high school and even many more years after college. So if you're going to campaign saying that you are the most transparent, open, and honest candidate in American political history, then live up to that claim.
And when was this that you contacted the campaign?
September of 07.
What transpired between when you saw him on TV and when you contacted the campaign? Did anything happen besides you talking to your Mexican buddies about how you knew this guy?
Nothing. Nothing at all. I knew he had announced in February of 07 that he was going to run. It was a good 6 months after he first announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination in 2008 that I even took the time to contact the campaign. It didn't matter to me when he announced that he was running. It only started mattering to me when all of these people were running around talking about Barack Obama was the next greatest thing since Christ was born. It was January of 2008 before I ever said anything publicly, because I bent over backwards, no pun intended here, to give the campaign the opportunity to simply clarify the dates. This was never meant to try to ruin him as a person or as a candidate. It was simply meant to, okay, if everybody is going to say that you are these things, then you need to live up to being those things. It was never meant to be one of those situations where you call a campaign or a candidate and you tell them, look, I've got this on you, you better come clean or else. That wasn't it. What really pushed this issue to the point of me going public with a YouTube video on January 17th of 08 was the fact that I get a call in September shortly after contacting the Obama campaign. And that call comes from a guy that identifies himself as a Mr. Young. And he claims in this call that he is from the Obama for America campaign. It's what he says in this call that tells me right away that this is not someone with the campaign, because it can't be. Because what he tells me, he asks me, he says, well, let me just get this straight. You want Barack Obama to come clean about his drug use. Why don't you want him to come clean about the sexual encounters? That right there tells me this isn't somebody from the campaign, because I never once mentioned the sexual encounters with the campaign.
Right.
So now I'm really freaking out. But I go with this because I have no idea who this person is. I do know that the person has the same cell phone numbers that I left with the campaign. So from September of 07 through early December of 07, I continued to get these phone calls and these text messages from a guy that originally claimed to be with the Obama campaign, that only later in these communications I find out is a gentleman by the name of Donald Young, who is an openly gay male, a school teacher in the Chicago school district, and the choir director of Obama's church, the one pastored by Reverend Jeremiah Wright. So in the course of this 4 months back and forth, it starts with, well, Senator Obama's looking into how they're going to make the statement, blah, 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 into becoming more personal and more open to where I'm being told that, okay, I'm not with the campaign. I'm actually a gay male that's been intimately and sexually involved with Barack Obama for years, who was asked to call you by Barack Obama and Jeremiah Wright to get as much information about who you've talked to about this in the media, all the way to the last communication telling me that any claims by the campaign claiming that they're going to come out and correct their drug use statement, not for me to hold my breath, because it's not going to happen. Then these communications end. I don't even tie or connect this guy to being the Donald Young that's murdered in Chicago on December 23rd of 2007, just, what, 10, 12 days before the Iowa caucus. I don't even put two and two together until the spring of 2008. By that time, I put the YouTube video out. And I put the YouTube video out because I had been speaking with different reporters, with different media outlets, from the New York Post to the New York Times to the Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune. I had even contacted the Democratic National Committee, had contacted the law offices of Vice President Walter Mondale. I was doing everything in my power to get the campaign to simply come out and clean up their misinformation, their false statements about the drug use, and then moving forward with the campaign.
Okay.
I bent over backwards to make sure that I did not engage in any communications with any opponents of Barack Obama, whether Republican or Democrat. I made it a point I was not going to get involved in contacting anyone connected with or associated with the Clinton campaign, the Biden campaign, the Edwards campaign, none of them. And I tried everything in my power to get this man to be honest about nothing more than the drug use. But when it became evident to me that that was not going to happen, I had a decision to make. And that decision was, if I make a public statement, then I'm going to have to make that statement completely honestly about the extent of what I know and how I know it. And people said, well, why did you even have to mention the gay sex? You could have just left the sex out of it and the drug stuff would have been enough. And I'm like, no, it wouldn't. See, because I'm asking him to be honest. I'm asking him to do what he claims he is. How does that make me look if I come out and accuse him of doing drugs, but I don't tell the whole story from Jump Street, and then people come back and they go, well, how do you know this? And then I explain to them, well, I know it because I was in the back of a limo going down on him while he was doing it. Then you have the opportunity for people to come back and say, oh, well, you're a lying sack of you-know-what, because why now you're throwing the sex into it? You want to make this something that it's not. Why didn't you tell the truth from the beginning? See, I would put myself in the position of being Barack Obama all over again if I didn't come out with the whole story from day one, as opposed to coming out with, well, I know you were using drugs in 1999, but I'm not going to tell you how I know that. And then come out 2 months later saying, well, I know it because I went down on you while you were doing it. And that's what people need to understand. It was never my intent to even have the sexual encounters come out. But I can't ask him to be honest about the extent of his drug use if I'm not willing to be honest about the whole story from the minute I go public and not just put out part of it only to come back later and add the rest of it and make myself look no different than Barack Obama.
So you went to the National Press Club with the story, right? When was that date?
I went to the National Press Club on June 18th of 2008 and held a press conference that the National Press Club themselves had no problem in taking the close to $9,000 that it cost us to rent the facility, to pay for their broadcast services, to videotape and archive the event. They began to be put under pressure by the far left, by Fire Dog Lake and the Obama camp and others, to where it turns out that everything we paid for, they basically ripped us off. I didn't realize it until after the fact, but they chose to make the room appear as if it could have been taking place anywhere in the world but the National Press Club. You have seen press conferences that have been held at the National Press Club. The podium has the National Press Club emblem stuck on the center of the podium, or else the wall behind the speaker says press.org, National Press Club, Washington, D.C.
Okay.
They made sure that absolutely nothing that could identify the place of this press conference was the National Press Club as far as in the background. If you watch that video, you would think that it could be any conference room in any hotel anywhere in the world.
You'd try to get your money back?
No, because what I wanted to do instead was I wanted to show that the National Press Club is not what they claim to be, because it turns out the National Press Club also engaged in working with Joe Biden's son, Bo Biden, in arranging for my arrest at the National Press Club, but it didn't go the way they had originally planned it. So when it did take place, they kind of stuck their foot in and didn't want it to become a scene. They had originally tried to plan it to where it would take place before the press conference even started.
Where is the National Press Club?
Is in Washington, D.C.
Right, and isn't Biden done? Isn't he in Delaware?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how could he arrest you?
Apparently, Bo Biden, on February 4th or 5th of 2008, secured a sealed grand jury indictment against me, accusing me of theft of $1,000 or more. They claimed that they mailed notice of the indictment to me, only if you saw the court record, you would notice that the court record shows that they never mailed anything because they never put an address on anything. Apparently, this warrant was not in the NCIC system, which is the National Crime Information System that all law enforcement agencies use. It was in there, but only within a 250-mile radius.
Okay.
The charge itself was brought about 17 days after my YouTube video went public on January 17th of 2008, shortly after his father, Joe Biden, dropped out of the 2008 Democratic nominating race. I had been in Washington, D.C. on May 31st of 2008 to attend the DNC's National Committee's Rules and Bylaw Committee meeting that took place at the Marriott Wardman, where they were arguing over how the DNC was counting delegates or designating delegates between Obama and Clinton out of Florida and Michigan because the DNC had penalized the two of them and didn't allow their primary votes to count or something.
Right.
So it wasn't unknown by Delaware or anyone else as far as where I was at or where I was living. In fact, at the time that they brought this sealed indictment, it was already public knowledge of my address in Duluth, Minnesota, because it was posted all over the internet by the likes of Joseph Farah with WorldNet Daily and the former Court TV, I guess they call it now SmokingGun.com or something. My whereabouts was public knowledge at that point, so Delaware had no excuse for claiming that they didn't know where I was at or how to contact me, because that just wasn't the case. Apparently, the so-called charge, the National Press Club, got together with Washington, D.C. authorities, who decided to have me arrested at the press club and claim that I was arrested on a fugitive from justice warrant. Problem is there was never a fugitive from justice warrant that ever existed. In fact, when I was taken into custody on the 18th of June at the National Press Club, the authorities were asked to produce a copy of the warrant in which they were claiming they were placing me under arrest on, and they said they didn't have it. First, they said they had it downstairs in the garage in the car. So we walked down to the garage. Guess what? They still can't find it. They still don't have it. When they cuff me and take me into Metro DC's District 1 for processing, even once we get into the district station, they still cannot produce a copy of any warrant that they claim calls for my arrest as a fugitive from justice.
Okay.
It wasn't until the next day when I was taken before a U.S. magistrate in the D.C. court that D.C. officials actually filed their own charge for a warrant to arrest me as a fugitive from justice out of Delaware. So they had actually arrested me 24 hours before they had even brought charges on me.
Why not? They can make up the rules, right?
Exactly. They arrest me. I'm held in the D.C. jail for 6 days. I'm not allowed any phone calls. I'm not allowed to make contact with my attorney, who at the time was the strange kilt-wearing Montgomery Sibley. I was denied access to all of my medications, which I was prescribed to take, that were sitting in my hotel. The officer, or the U.S. Marshal, that actually processed me in at District 1 was kind enough to provide me with his cell phone long enough to call the hotel and let them know that I had been taken into custody so that they could secure my belongings in the hotel until I was able to make arrangements.
That was nice of them.
It really was. But for 6 days, I sat in a D.C. jail. I was never let out of the cell. I was never allowed to make phone calls to anyone. I was never allowed medication.
Isn't that against the law?
Well, technically it is, but look, they get away with doing what they do when they know that you don't have the resources to fight them back.
Right.
It was on the 23rd of June. I believe it was the 23rd of June. I would have to go back, but I'm almost positive it was the 23rd of June that my cell door opened and I was told that I was being transported to Delaware. A individual with the Delaware Attorney General's office had come to D.C. to transport me to Wilmington. On the drive, he told me that he did not know why D.C. had done what they had done, because the type of warrant that was out of Delaware is common in the District of Columbia, and the District of Columbia has never taken anyone into custody and held them for Delaware to come pick them up. In fact, the normal process would be that you go before a magistrate in D.C. and the magistrate gives you 24 hours to get on Amtrak and show up in Delaware to address the issue. And I had told him that I had actually attempted to make that request of the magistrate, but not only did he not want to hear me, the U.S. Marshals in that courtroom physically grabbed me and took me out of that courtroom, telling me I didn't have the right to even open my mouth to the judge.
Is this America we're talking about, or?
It wasn't just with me. Apparently, they did that with anyone. You had to let whatever attorney the court had put in that courtroom to speak for you, despite the fact that the attorney had never even spoken to you before you were taken into that courtroom. You didn't even know that that attorney was there to speak for you.
This is ridiculous. ridiculous.
So I was ordered held, and eventually they took me back in the courtroom, and the attorney that they had assigned asked the judge exactly what I wanted to ask her, which was, why can't I simply go out of here, get on Amtrak, and go to Wilmington and take care of this? But no. They wanted to make a whole big old stink. They wanted to use what Ben Smith and Politico had put out the day before on Politico's website. They wanted to claim that, no, he's a flight risk. He's lived under 14 different names and aliases, which is completely false, but people don't want to clarify. They want to put out what they get from an FBI printout.
Right.
Well, if you go by what the FBI says, I was born in 1963 and my birthday's in July, not in September.
Right.
And I'm actually 49 and not almost 51. The court said, oh no, he's got all these aliases, but yet they know that these aliases are nothing more than what individuals that have had interviews with police 20 years earlier referred to me as. And the funny thing is the majority of these so-called aliases are just different misspellings of my legal name at the time. So I sat there for 6 days, but the interesting thing is when I arrive in Wilmington, Delaware, I am in a holding cell for about 3 minutes. I appear before a judge by video conference, and I am immediately released on my own recognizance to return home to Minnesota with the understanding that I will have to come back to Delaware on certain dates to address these charges. Yeah. Long and the short of it, a little more than 2 months later, and some close to $30,000 broker, the state of Delaware dismisses the charges, claiming that they have no evidence to support them. And they only do this the day before Beau Biden's father accepts the DNC nomination as the VP choice.
At the press club,
mm-hmm.
And that was, what, June 18th, you said?
June 18th, 2008.
You went right from the press club to jail.
Yep, that's not even the best part of this. These people from Politico and the Obama supporters couldn't even be happy with that. They wanted to actually make a scene at the press club that they could put out on the internet and put on the nightly news, but it backfired. One of them actually called Metro Police and had two uniformed patrol officers go running into the press club asking for me and demanding that I turn around, that I'm going to jail, only to have the U.S. Marshal and the detectives from the Metro DC Police Department look at them and tell them to back off, that they have nothing to do with this, that they have this under control. So these two officers who were trying to make a big old scene in front of television and media cameras at the press club end up being told to exit the room with their tails between their legs.
Oh my God.
But it didn't stop the media from actually making reports that I was hauled off in handcuffs, which I wasn't. I walked out of that place with not a cuff on me.
How many members of the quote-unquote media were in that room?
I had originally reserved the Lissagor room, which could hold up to 40 people. That was already overbooked before we even got the press cards even printed or ready to print. We moved it to the Holman Lounge and had 120 chairs that were set up in the room itself, and I don't think there was two empty chairs in it. In fact, there were quite a few people that were standing up in the back because there were no chairs available.
Wow. Was it all the media, even the corrupt mainstream media, they were there also?
Oh, CBS, The New Republic, Politico, Reason, MSNBC, C-SPAN, CNN, they were all there, and not a single one of them wanted to report anything other than what Politico and Dave Weigel tried to do, which was try to make me look like a lunatic, and Huffington Post, of course, reporting it, talking about the most stupefying press conference in the world by the biggest circus clown in the media.
Yeah, it's amazing how they walk in lockstep. That never ceases to amaze me. And people say that we have an independent press. It's such a bunch of BS. There's no such thing as an independent press here. How could they ignore the stories that they ignore in unison? Incredible. It's mind-numbing when you think about it. When you actually think about all of the press outlets, the prominent, the mainstream media outlets in this country, and how they literally, they report on the same damn thing every day, day in and day out. So basically, they ignored you. You went to jail. You got out the day before Biden was announced as the VP candidate. They dismissed charges. Anything significant happened after that?
Well, what happened afterwards is it demonstrated the organization behind the efforts to silence me. The people who were adamant that I was going to go to jail for the rest of my life because Delaware could prove that I had counterfeited some money orders, which I didn't. They knew this. They knew this long before they ever even tried to bring an indictment. In fact, they had investigated all of it and had not determined that there were no criminal charges whatsoever that applied, only to wait and decide 2 months later when I go public about something on Obama and all of a sudden it's a crime. What significantly happened was, after the dismissal, I managed to find postings of why people in the media were actually doing what we were just talking about, which was ignoring in lockstep. It turns out that you have these people behind the scenes that were making phone calls and sending emails to these media outlets and to their attorneys and to the reporters, flat out telling them that if they allowed Sinclair a venue, a platform, if they allowed me to speak or be broadcast on their airways, that they and their corporations would be sued for libel and slander. Problem is you can't sue for libel and slander if it's the truth. And you can't sue for libel and slander if you're a political public figure candidate telling the people of the country that they need to believe what you say.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter, Larry. They could tie you up in court. Look at how much money they cost you. They don't care about the truth. They just care about tying you up and costing you money, right?
Well, I just spent the last 2 years, from 2010 to February of 2012, fighting a $30 million defamation suit over my first book, only to prevail. But you're right. They succeeded in doing what they wanted to do. They cost Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon, myself, Ingram Content Group. They cost them enough money in having to respond and defend against it to the point to where they just decided, you know what, it's not worth it from a financial standpoint. I give Barnes & Noble credit. I give Amazon credit. I give Books A Million credit because rather than settle and cave in and pay these people anything, they did fight it. They did prevail. I fought it. I prevailed. Unfortunately, I had to fight it a little bit longer because I didn't have the resources that these companies had. So I had to fight Washington, D.C.'s most powerful lobbying law firm, Patton Boggs, on my own. So I think it's a sweet victory to know that little old me can stand up against some of the most powerful attorneys in this country and win. But you're right. It's all about tying you up and costing you excessive amounts of money to the point to where people would rather just remain silent and just turn their head and act like they don't know nothing than to get involved in having to stand up for the truth anymore.
Right. That same thing happened to me with the New York Stock Exchange. They sued me and I didn't back down. I fought them and I did win. But again, it was somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory, as they call it. But I did prevail in court and I was able to speak my mind. And what I had to say was protected by the First Amendment. But this is what they do. It's a game that they play. And it's unfortunate that they abuse the law of the land, the Constitution, to get their own way. And these people should be brought up on charges. And I'm sorry that you went through what you went through and all this. But where does it stand here now with all this?
I am moving forward with Sinclair News and Ellis News Group. I'm moving forward with my radio program, Through the Mirror with Larry Sinclair. I can stand here today and say that the book Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder, is not defamatory. It's not libelous, and it has not been proven to be dishonest in any way, shape, or form, and it won't be. In fact, a U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. has determined that there is no indication whatsoever that the book is slanderous, libelous, or untrue in any way, shape, or form. The book is still in print. It's still available. Unfortunately, it's only available either directly through us or through individuals who have their own Amazon stores that order in bulk and sell over Amazon. It is available through Amazon Kindle if people want a Kindle version. Mm-hmm. I think after 4+ years of dealing with this and standing firm on what I have said and never backing down, I think people are starting to see the truth. I think people are willing to take a different look and look at it from a different perspective. I don't think everyone is automatically so quick to just dismiss me off as being some lunatic. Most of what I have said about Barack Obama has turned out to materialize as fact over the last 4+ years. So that's definitely comforting to know. I think at this point, and it's kind of what I told the people when I spoke at Freedom Palooza, where I met you, this is no longer about me, and I want people to understand I never wanted this to be about me, and even today I say it's not about me. What it's about is it's about the corruption. It's about the level of dishonesty that we have in the media, that we have in our elected officials. It is about the extent to which people and organizations will go to in attacking someone or trying to retaliate or bring about retribution against anyone who dares speak out against the establishment. I think it's interesting that MSNBC was one of the prime media sources over the last 4+ years that wanted to attack me on a personal level and portray me as being some character assassin. And yet, when they are sued and their Rachel Maddow personality is sued for libel and slander and defamation, they have used the very case brought against me and the very court rulings that rule in my favor to argue that they should be protected. I think it's just sweet irony that the very people who turned around and said that I was everything in the book but honest and credible are now using my very words to defend themselves against attack. So I think it's sweet to know that they have to resort to using the very defenses that I've used against them in defending against people that are going after them now. So.
Right. They have to use the truth. You know, these people are nothing but whores and traitors, as far as I'm concerned. Larry, I read something about you getting a polygraph. Did that happen? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, actually, I did. There was a polygraph that was done on February 22nd of 2008 that was arranged by the internet site WhiteHouse.com and its owner, Dan Parisi. It was done by Edward Gelb, and the site WhiteHouse.com reported that I had failed the polygraph. Since that time, there's been multiple claims and statements that I have failed multiple polygraph exams by multiple examiners. Even WhiteHouse.com attempted to claim that I had failed a polygraph and that I had failed based on multiple polygraph experts examining me. That's slightly misleading and dishonest. I did take a single polygraph test that was performed by a single polygraph examiner by the name of Edward Gelb. Mr. Gelb is famous for being known as the polygrapher to the stars, who am being chosen because there are reports that you can basically purchase the results that you want through Edward Gelb. But it seems that despite the claims that I failed, if you look at the video itself, which was only recently released, in fact, it was filed as an exhibit in that court case, in the defamation case last August 2011, and we have made the entire polygraph video available because it proves some things that we have said all along. One, did not fail the polygraph test, and contrary to a bunch of people's claims that when the computer says you passed and the examiner says you fail, that the examiner's interpretation is what is used. There is no such regulation or practice that says that's the case. In fact, if you take Dr. George Masick from the antipolygraph.org report that he did for us back in September of last year, you will find that one, Edward Gelb, you can see on videotape announcing that he thinks that I am a complete nutcase, a lying asshole, etc., etc. By making those claims himself, Edward Gelb violated the first rule of the ethics code for polygraph examiners, which says that if you hold any bias to the subject, you cannot perform a polygraph examination of that person. The fact that he displayed those biases during and after the polygraph exam, those should have been made public. They were hidden. But if you watch this video, you will find that Edward Gelb and Dan Parisi's assistant, Robert Braddock, who was recently arrested in Connecticut for conspiracy to conceal campaign contributions.
Nice.
Exactly. Eventually, the truth about people comes out. But if you watch the video, you will see Edward Gelb telling Robert Braddock that here's a result that the computer gave on me and whether I was lying or not that says I was being honest. But yet he dismissed it, telling Robert Braddock that, no, that can't be right because his blood pressure. Another thing you will see on the video that people don't understand is when you do polygraph exams, the blood pressure cup is applied to one arm, and the little electron thingies that are connected to the tip of the finger are done on the other hand. Edward Gelb connected both of them onto my left arm, whereby he could manipulate my blood pressure by the amount of pressure in the cup that he inflated. I tried to bring that up. He said that it didn't matter, but doctors tend to say that he's lying through his teeth on that one. But nonetheless, people say that I failed multiple polygraph tests. If you look at the reports from Dr. Masick, if you watch the entire video, I think you will find that those claims that I failed multiple polygraphs are a lie. You will see that I only did one polygraph with one polygraph examiner, and based on the actual computer data from both of those, I passed. And I passed with flying colors.
Have you thought about doing another one?
You know, people have asked me, and I think about it when they ask, and then I think about it this way. When it was first announced that I was going to do a polygraph, the first thing everybody on the left, or that was supporting Obama, started saying was, oh, polygraphs don't mean shit, they're inadmissible in court, they're not proof of nothing, blah, blah, blah. The minute WhiteHouse.com decided they were going to claim that I lied, that the polygraph showed I was lying, all of a sudden those very same people that said, oh, polygraphs don't mean nothing, they don't prove nothing, all of a sudden they were the people going, well, look, he's lying, it proves it right here. So even if I did a polygraph today and the examiner was honest and it showed the same results that the computer analysis of the first one showed, which was I was telling the truth, people would still turn around, you would have people say, oh, this examiner's just lying, because so it won't prove anything to anyone. It'll just give people reason to question. And like I said, it's no longer about me. I think Barack Obama's own actions, his own words, and the actions of those that work with him and for him have more than proven my allegations to be substantiated without any doubt.
Right. And I'm very grateful that you have retained your memory. It's very impressive. I used to have a memory, perhaps not that good, but I did used to have one. But I'm glad you still have yours, because it came in handy, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book. Then after I read that, then it would be great to have you on again, and then we can go over the book and do a book review. Larry Sinclair of Sinclair News, LS News Group, and the author of Barack Obama and Larry Sinclair, Cocaine, Sex, Lies, and Murder, that's a question mark. Larry, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners. It's a fascinating story. I never knew about it in detail. Thank you for taking the time out to really elaborate on it and let the listeners decide.
Dave, thank you for inviting me on. I appreciate it. It was interesting. It was nice to meet you at Freedom Palooza. And if you have any other questions, feel free to ask.